Good afternoon. I'm Clarice Larson, and you're listening to KTOL. Heavy rains and flooding in southeast Alaska triggered a series of small landslides in Ketchikan yesterday that blocked roads and damaged a home. The most destructive slide came down just after 1 a.m. on Wednesday morning off North Tongass Highway. The slide happened on a pair of private properties north of town. Ketchikan Fire Chief Rick Hines said the earth of one property gave way, taking a large chunk of the homeowner's driveway with it. The slide then hit the first floor of another home below, damaging it and the resident's car. Hines says the people in the damaged home were evacuated without injuries. City spokeswoman Kim Simpson said in a text to KRBD that there have been no additional slides on the property. Airport weather data shows Ketchikan saw nearly 7 inches of rain in the couple of days before the slide. It's one of the wettest Mays on record in the first city. The town averages over 150 inches of rainfall a year. The U.S. Forest Service is also reporting significant flooding in the Ward Lake campground area north of town. Another slide came down yesterday, blocking White River Road in a remote area further north. The Ketchikan Borough says the slide trapped a logging crew, a construction crew, and a handful of employees of a local outdoor adventure tour company. State Transportation Department crews managed to clear a path through the slide zone after about 7 hours. No injuries have been reported in any of yesterday's landslides or flood events. This is KTOL. Good afternoon. I'm Clarice Larson, and you're listening to KTOO. Canceled federal funding and grants have stalled the construction of a Juneau affordable housing project for at least a year. The project is aimed specifically at people in recovery from substance misuse, and the delay means the dozens of people it could have housed will have to find another option. KTOO has more. Rain drizzles down as Jonathan Swinton walks down a muddy road in Lemon Creek. He points to an open area filled with bright green foliage and spruce trees, where he says construction on 51 units of affordable housing should have been underway.
By now, they would have had the foundations poured.
Swinton is the executive director of Gastineau Human Services, a nonprofit that helps people affected by homelessness or addiction. The nonprofit was expected to break ground here last month for a three-story building with 51 long-term housing units. The housing is designed and designated for people in recovery from substance misuse, reentering society after incarceration, or facing housing instability.
There's 51 units that we were hoping to have under construction right now that are missing, and that's 51 people that this community isn't able to house. That it could.
Housing advocates say the units are sorely needed, but the Trump administration pulled a key grant and Congress nixed earmarked funds. Swinton says that set the project back.
Realistically, I will be very surprised if we can break ground before April of next year.
The nonprofit was relying on the congressional earmark and grant from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to cover most of the project's cost. It hadn't been awarded either of them yet, but Swinton says the organization was confident enough to set a construction date. Swinton says nonprofits like Gastineau Human Services depend on federal funding to provide services to housing insecure and unhoused people in the community.
The tragic part of the whole thing is that people don't have the support that they need to get into a place where they can keep themselves from slipping up again. And that's what this housing is trying to do.
The news comes as some Juneau residents are calling for police to crack down on homeless encampments in town. City officials and police say that isn't an easy fix to the growing rates of homelessness and its impacts. But creating more housing is a start. Dave Ringel runs Juneau's St. Vincent de Paul chapter, a nonprofit that provides various type of housing assistance and operates the city's warming shelter.
The housing is the key to keeping people from that homeless cycle. And not having enough supported housing and enough low-income rental housing in this community is probably the driving force behind our homelessness problem.
Ringel says service providers in Juneau are already stretched thin with resources. Data on the number of unhoused people living in Juneau is very limited, but information collected by the Homeless Management Information System indicates that over the last 3 years, the number of people in Juneau who receive housing assistance is roughly 350 to 400 individuals.
Every time we get a vacancy, we have 3 to 4 people who could fill the vacancy within our transitional housing. Our rental units are 100% leased. We could probably provide double the number of units that we currently have.
Ringel and Swinton say the urgency to build this type of housing is only growing. Gastineau Human Services is already reapplying for the federal grant and looking for other funding options. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson. And many communities along Alaska's southern coast are dependent on state ferries to get around and to fuel their economies. But those ferries move thanks to teams of onboard engineers. And those engineer room employees say they are critically understaffed. And the only solution is more state funding or fewer sailings. KRBD's Jack Darrell has more.
Megan Nye doesn't always know when or if her work week will end. She's an engineer on the Alaska Marine Highway System Ferry Columbia. She's supposed to work 2-week shifts, but sometimes, more and more often, those 2 weeks will turn to 6.
I love my job, but I don't want to be there all the time, and I want to have a schedule so I can plan my off time. And just the not knowing if I'm going to be able to go home.
Nye is what's called a second engineer. She works down in the Columbia's bowels, maintaining the ferry's 3 boilers, fuel, HVAC, refrigeration, basically every complicated, worrying thing. She and 5 other engineers work in split 12-hour shifts, so the engine room is manned 24 hours a day. If that metal box in the bottom of the ship isn't properly manned, then the ship doesn't sail. She says it's a safety thing. You know, there's a minimum number of staff to keep the vessel and its passengers safe.
That's our nightmare, is having to cancel a sailing.
Nye says there are 2 ways to become a ferry engineer. You can do 4 years at a maritime academy, or you can be what they call a hawse piper, basically apprenticing. And after 5 or so years at sea, you can study and take 5 tests to get your license. That's what she did. But that's more difficult now.
So we have a lot less people coming up the hawse pipe. Because they have families, you know, the money, they can't just leave for that time.
She says that's because the regulations have gotten tighter, more classes, more costs. And staffing shortages aren't exclusive to below deck crew. About 3 years ago, 60% of the ferry system's jobs were vacant. They've been slowly closing that gap. But officials say the ferry system is still 10% short of the minimum number of masters and bridge crew. And the engineers union says they're short nearly 20% of that minimum. Josh Chevalier is the chief engineer on the Columbia. He says it's a problem for all ferry jobs, but because engineers are behind the scenes, they're often forgotten by the public and lawmakers.
When people are stressed out and unhappy, I have to balance like the needs of the vessel with, you know, the needs of people's lives.
Chevalier has worked in the ferry system for over 20 years. He says the problem with filling jobs started about a decade ago. Chevalier says the ferry's funding woes go back to a larger problem he sees in the state. He says the state's major population centers, like Anchorage, have a lot more sway in the legislature. He says for them, infrastructure like the ferries and the engineers down in their bellies are out of sight, out of mind.
Haul a tremendous amount of traffic that never stops in the southeast and drives up to South Central and stays in hotels and buys fuel and groceries, stays in Airbnbs. So it's a very valuable economic engine for the entire state, but I believe it's viewed as sort of welfare for southeast.
The Union for Ferry System Engineers brokered their current agreement with the state back in 2022. That agreement governs everything from what engineers wear to when they can get off the ship. Expires next month. So the engineers union has been bargaining with the state. They recently reached a tentative new 3-year agreement. Union representatives said they couldn't comment on the terms of the new agreement until it's signed. But engineers like Nye say that agreement could essentially determine the ferry system's future.
I mean, the number one thing that will fix the problem is money, right? It's the pay issue. And so trying to attract people from the academies.
The state recently reached an agreement with a different, bigger union of state government employees. That agreement included more health care coverage and an 11% pay increase. Chevalier says that a hiring push for engineers is a race against time. 30% of the ferry system's engineers are approaching retirement age, and he says in 5 years, busted boilers or a faulty refrigerator could be a much bigger problem. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
And Alaska volcano researchers say seismic activity around Mount Spur has continued to decline over the last month, but the closest active volcano to the state's population centers could still erupt. In March, officials with the Alaska Volcano Observatory noted an increase in gas emissions at Spur, about 80 miles west of Anchorage. At the time, they said an eruption was likely to occur within weeks or months. However, in mid-April, volcanic activity at Spur started to decrease. Volcanic geologist Christy Wallace says that downward trend in activity has continued.
We think that that magma has stalled, so it just isn't moving, meaning we're not seeing earthquakes that reflect movement, and we're not seeing any deformation, so that pause continues.
Wallace emphasized that the volcano is still at a yellow alert level, indicating that volcanic activity at Spur is well above normal, and an eruption is still possible. She says current activity at Spur is similar to 2004 and 2005 when it reached yellow level but ultimately didn't erupt. But she says there's one important distinction with how this event unfolded.
The big difference is that we saw a lot of earthquakes right under Crater Peak, and that's what got us really concerned. And that's why there was a lot of preparedness in the community across South Central Alaska, is because that type of activity resulted in an eruption in 1992. And we didn't want to be short-sighted and not let our community know about that.
Wallace says signs of a pending eruption would include an increase in gas emissions, deformation of the peak, and a rise in shallow earthquakes near the volcano. This is KTOL.